14 months ago, Yingying Zhang, a visiting scholar from China, disappeared from the University of Illinois campus. Today, we hear from her friends about how they'd like everyone to remember her.
I think Yingying kind of represents a large group of international students who come to U.S. The purpose of the coming is to fulfill their dream.
Plus, the sexual abuse crisis within the Catholic Church, Illinois Supreme Court Justice Anne Burke says we need new investigations here in Illinois.
If they had only done what we asked them to do, and what they asked us to do was to find out how many offenders and how many victims there were. But they withheld. They withheld the information. It's obvious.
And Chicago novelist Abby Gini joins us to talk about her latest novel, The Wildlands. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, the Chinese Student Scholar Association at the U of I joins us to share about the organization's plans for a memorial garden for missing scholar Yingying Zhang. We also find out how Chinese students on campus are reacting to her disappearance 14 months ago. Also, Chicago novelist Abby Gini is here to talk about her latest novel, The Wildlands. But first, as you've no doubt been following in the news, earlier this month, a Pennsylvania grand jury found that about 300 priests in six of the state's dioceses had allegedly abused young people in their care. The fallout has reached the very top of the church, with Pope Francis asking for forgiveness for abuses during his recent trip to Ireland, all while an ex-Vatican official has accused the Pope of ignoring misconduct for years. These stories are affecting Catholics and non-Catholics around the world and right here in Illinois, including some very high-ranking officials, including Cardinal Blaise Supich, who was also named in this letter. Attorney General Lisa Madigan is also looking for answers, and she's created a hotline for victims of clergy sex abuse so they may come forward. We're going to tweet that number out and have it on our website, but joining me now to talk more about this is Illinois Public Radio Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey. Brian, I wonder if we could start with this letter. What is Cardinal Supich accused of in this?
He's accused of his elevation being part of a cover-up of Cardinal McCarrick's, this Washington church official who was accused of sex abuse, sex harassment. This letter comes from somebody who has clashed with Pope Francis, has really been on the other side of a sort of ideological split in what should be the emphasis of the church's teachings recently. And so Supich and others have pointed out that there's a lot of sort of personal bitterness and personal history here that seems like could be at play beyond just these accusations. That, and again, so this the cardinal who wrote the letter, one of his main claims is that he put forth a group of names to be the next archbishop in Chicago before Supich was elevated. Supich wasn't on that list. The Pope reached outside and chose Supich, and he's somehow alleging some sort of conspiracy here that involves this McCarrick, who was accused of wrongdoing.
Cardinal Supich has responded. We have some audio of him on public media station WTTW.
That statement seems to imply that all of a sudden I fell out of the sky. I have been appointed by three popes as bishop. I don't think that anybody walks into the Pope's office and says, oh, by the way, here's a guy I'm pulling out of the hat, you should appoint him. That's absurd. There's some payback going on here of relationships that soured between him and other people in Rome over the years. And I think there's a real bitterness there.
That's Cardinal Blaise Supich on WTTW. We're speaking with Brian Mackey about this crisis within the Catholic Church. You spoke to Illinois Supreme Court Justice Anne Burke about this. She's a lifelong Catholic, former member of the National Review Board for the Protection of Children and Young People. Brian, what does she think needs to happen?
She, as you mentioned, she was on this review board that was appointed by the church to investigate sexual wrongdoing among priests. This followed the big, you know, the investigations in Spotlight that were eventually turned into a movie and sparked this worldwide furor in the church. She was a member of that commission, and she believes that she and the other commissioners did not get full cooperation and all the information. She says it's obvious the church withheld information from her group, so what she is calling for now are government investigations. You know, we've heard the church respond. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, after this Pennsylvania grand jury report, says it's doing its own investigation into the Cardinal McCarrick allegations of wrongdoing. But she says it's time for civil authorities, like state's attorneys here in Illinois. In Pennsylvania, they were able to have a statewide grand jury. Illinois law is a little different on that point. But she's basically saying that the government really needs to step in. The church cannot be trusted to investigate itself.
And Brian, to that point, attorney Lisa Madigan has been quick to respond to this issue. On Monday, she announced a hotline for victims of clergy sexual abuse to come forward. That hotline number, we'll say it a couple of times, but it's 888-414-7678. She's also seeking records from the Pennsylvania grand jury and plans to meet with church officials here. What do you think the end goal is?
Well, there were a number of Illinois priests, Catholic priests, named in this Pennsylvania report. And I think what she seems to want to get, Attorney General Madigan seems to want to get to is, you know, what role could they have done wrongdoing here in Illinois? Could this have been part of the cover-up that was alleged in the Pennsylvania report? She says that she had asked for sit-down meetings with all of the bishops here in Illinois, including Cardinal Supich in Chicago. The cardinal says, sure, you can have our files. In fact, you already have them because we've released them previously. Mm-hmm. So there's some question here about what exactly, you know, is she doing a full investigation? Is this something just to, sort of for appearances? The church says we've already been cooperating. We've cooperated fully. But again, as we said with Justice Burke, she believes that the information has been withheld in the past and that you do need more government investigations.
That's Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey. Again, that hotline number that we mentioned that Attorney General Lisa Madigan has set up is 888-414-7678. That's 888-414-7678 for victims of clergy sexual abuse. We'll have this up on our website. We'll tweet out Brian's story with Illinois Supreme Court Justice Ann Burke. Brian, thanks for being with me.
Good to talk to you, Nyla.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The country continues to mourn the death of Arizona Senator John McCain, who passed away this past weekend. Yesterday, Illinois' senior senator Dick Durbin spoke about John McCain on the Senate floor.
Madam President, this is a sad time for the Senate and our nation. With the passing of John McCain, our country lost a legend, and this Senate has lost a towering figure. I've lost a friend. I first met him 35 years ago. In 1982, we were brand new freshman congressmen elected to the U.S. House. I spotted him on the other side of the floor in the Senate, and of course knew instantly who he was, and worked up the courage to go over and introduce myself. And then I asked him a favor. I said, John, would you consider doing a cable TV show that I could send back to my central Illinois district? And he said, sure, I'd be glad to. And I thought, that's amazing. A Democratic congressman asking a new Republican congressman to help him back in his district, and John McCain said yes. It was the beginning of a friendship. That cable show wasn't shown beyond central Illinois, but I still remember it and still thank John for its act of kindness. It was my first exposure to a unique style of communication that America would come to know as the Straight Talk Express.
That's Senator Dick Durbin speaking about his colleague, former Senator John McCain, on the Senate floor. Today would have been his 82nd birthday. He is lying in state in the Arizona Capitol today. There will be a service in Phoenix tomorrow. On Friday, Senator McCain is scheduled to lie in state at the Capitol Rotunda. Chicago writer Abby Jeanney has been writing novels since she was a little kid. She's also always been in love with the outdoors. So perhaps it's fitting that her second novel is called The Wildlands. It comes out next Tuesday, and it's a story not just about nature, but about survival, family, and making it on your own. I spoke with Abby earlier from our studios at Northwestern University in Evanston, and I started by asking her if she's always been someone who reads and writes about animals.
In a word, yes. I've become one of those people where people are like, you write about animals. Here's a book about animals. So I have a huge library of nonfiction books that I read constantly about animals, about the natural world. I love documentaries. I'm just constantly absorbing.
And in this case, this novel starts with this pretty amazing scene of, and it's this description of a tornado hitting a home in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any personal experience with this?
Well, my husband's family, my wonderful in-laws, are Oklahomans. They actually live, their kids went to school in Moore, where that huge tornado hit a couple years ago. So, like, school was canceled because there was no more school because the building was gone. And an inspiration for this also, we had some really dear friends when I was a kid growing up, and they had this happen where their entire house, they were in the basement, and the entire house was taken away by the storm. And they heard the rain right above them. And it took them a minute to realize that you shouldn't be able to hear rain if you're in the basement. And when they came up, it was just a swath of destruction strewn across the landscape. So it hasn't happened to me, but it's happened sort of to my nearest and dearest.
And it sounds like you also, based on the description, did a lot of research into what it looks like when a tornado happens, because it's really vivid, that prologue of the minutes before the tornado touches down and hits the farm.
Well, thank you. Yes, I did a ton of research. And I confess I loved Twister and I love all of those disaster movies. I will also say this may not be interesting to anyone but me, but I often dream about tornadoes, and I have these incredibly vivid, terrifying dreams about them. So I feel like I've seen them often in my non-waking life.
Oh, that's terrible. When did those start?
They are correlated with migraines, which I get. Whenever I'm in a lot of physical pain, I dream about tornadoes.
Wow. And so did any of your dreams of tornadoes end up in this description?
Oh, yeah. The watching the, you know, the cloud take shape and watching the sky turn green and, you know, the birds flying backwards and upside down. All those things are things I've experienced in my terrible, terrible nightmares.
Oh, no. Well, I'm sorry about that. But it's great reading, I will say. So the Wildlands, main character is this little girl named Cora.
Mm-hmm.
Where did she come from?
She came from me. All my characters. I feel like writing is partly a process of creation and partly a process of discovery. So I always sort of feel like they're probably out there somewhere already existing, and my job is to kind of half make them, but also to kind of find them as they are. I will say I was a very tomboyish, tree-climbing, animal-obsessed little kid, and, you know, there's a lot of me in Cora.
That's what I was going to ask. And I also read that you started writing at a really early age.
I did. I started writing when I was about 6. So basically, as soon as I was able to write, I was writing. And I started writing like with the force of a freight train. Like I was writing novels by the time I was, you know, 8 or 9. I wrote for hours every day after school. And I thought this was completely normal. I was like, this is what one does. One goes home after school and one writes, you know, a novel. And it was not till I was in middle school, I was riding the bus home with a friend of mine. And she said, what are you doing after school today? And I said, well, I'm going to go home and write. And she said, write what? And I was like, oh, this is unusual. Like, it took me that long to figure it out. So I think there's some of that in Cora as well, because she kind of slips into this, you know, as the story progresses and she falls under her brother's influence more and more, she kind of disappears into this not quite reality. And I think that was a place I kind of lived in sometimes when I was creating stories as a kid.
Do you have siblings?
I have a younger brother.
And so there's a really interesting dynamic, because this story is about this family of 4 children and young people who are, I'm not going to give anything away, because if you read the first chapter, you know that they are orphaned. And
yes.
So it's basically the story of how the 18-year-old sister really is trying to raise all of the other kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really interesting dynamic. I have to say, when I was reading it in the beginning, I was kind of confused, because I thought it was something that was like set a long time ago. Because it sort of seemed like they were just on their own and really in this sort of isolated way. I wonder, where did you get the idea that kind of creating them off by themselves, and that it was really these 4 kids who are really struggling to figure everything out, and they don't really have any help?
That's true. I would say in an early draft of the book, there was a mother in it. And I thought it would be interesting to write a mother character who's kind of a non-entity. Like, she's there. She's not really helping. Darlene is in charge of everything. Darlene being the oldest sister. And my editor was actually the one who said, you know, it's more interesting if they're orphans and they have no support system whatsoever. So I think I may have leaned into that a little bit. But I also, there's that, I don't know, it's like a fantasy slash nightmare of childhood where you're off on your own. Like the Boxcar Children and, you know, a lot of those stories of, you know, kids kind of growing up in this feral, wild state. And so there's some of that where it's kind of a wonderful dream that you have as a kid. And it's also sort of a terrible thing that if it happens in real life, it's a nightmare.
Right. And there's this line in the book when Cora realizes how different she is, how other kids have families, they have parents to go home to. And she doesn't really even remember her parents because she's the youngest one. And so she doesn't remember them at all.
Yeah, that was something that I was interested in, too. Like, Cora, her waking life kind of begins with the storm. So, you know, the other siblings, they remember their parents. They remember having a home. They remember having a father who took care of them. Cora, you know, her life began sort of when the tornado blew through town and took everything away. So I was interested in what that would be like for that kind of that child who's off on their own to not have a memory of a life before that.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Chicago writer Abby Jeanie. Her second novel, The Wildlands, comes out next Tuesday. You're listening to The 21st.
Support for the 21st comes from the University of Illinois Press, publishers of University of Illinois, Engine of Innovation, documenting 175 years of innovation in agriculture, engineering, and the arts at the University of Illinois. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Abby Jeanie. She's a Chicago writer whose second novel, The Wildlands, comes out next Tuesday. There's also a launch party next Tuesday at Women and Children First Bookstore at 7 o'clock. The Wildlands is set in rural Oklahoma, and it's in part a story about a young girl named Cora who becomes orphaned after a tornado hits her family home. It's a far cry from Abby's own upbringing in Evanston, but she knows about Oklahoma through her in-laws. So I asked her to talk a little bit more about why she thought this was the right place to set this novel.
I was really struck by the place when I was there. Whenever I would visit, I would think, this is a whole other world. I remember, you know, we'd come in the summer and all of this grass would just be like this weird, eerie yellow because you cannot water it enough for it to survive in that sunlight. So
really different from where you grew up in Evanston by Lake Michigan,
yes,
right?
Yes, I grew up in a little garden, you know, and then I would go to this sort of like desert place where they were scorpions that you had to, you know, like my husband would tell me stories about, you know, you'd see the scorpion on the ceiling and you'd try to hit it with a shoe. And I was like, yeah, there are no scorpions where I grew up. That seems like, I don't know, a strange place. But yeah, I did a lot of research. I do a lot of research about everything I write. And I loved reading about the animals of that place and also reading about what's happening to the small towns. Because I think that, you know, they are struggling, they are dying. They are in a place that is not really a sustainable place for humans to live. And that's part of what's happening to them.
And I also think the really interesting part of this is the interplay with animals. And I think there's kind of this tendency that often people would think they would have to anthropomorphize them. But you actually don't really, like, the animals are animals. Like, there's no human traits here. And in fact, if anything, the humans are more like animals, I feel like, in this. Was that I imagine, a deliberate choice on your part? You're nodding.
Yes. That is a very deliberate choice on my part. I think the tendency to anthropomorphize is really harmful for both humans and for animals, so the way we interact with them. And I think that we are animals. You know, we are of the primate family. You know, we are connected to apes, and we are connected to monkeys, and we are connected to everything. And we think of ourselves as being so separate. And that's bad for us. It's bad for us in so many different ways. It's bad for our world. It's bad for the way we treat our world. I think it's bad for our spirits and our souls. And so when I thought about writing this, the last thing I want is to write animals that are like people. I want to illustrate the fact that we are actually like them because we are them, because, you know, we're an unusual kind of animal, but we are part of the animal kingdom. This planet is our planet. You know, these animals, their instincts and their nature can tell us something about our own. Rather than the other way around, I guess.
Right. And I wonder, as you're saying that, I feel like I'm hearing a little bit of Cora's Big Brother in your voice here. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about Cora's brother.
Well, Tucker is sort of the human tornado in the story. He's an eco-terrorist, and he, you know, disappears from the family for a while and then comes back with a vengeance and, you know, sets off a bomb and basically kidnaps Cora, and that kicks off the plot as the two of them on this eco-terrorist spree across the Southwest. And I was interested in writing a character who is right in his motivations but wrong in his actions, because a lot of times I agree with Tucker. Like, I know, you know, he is someone who knows all the things that I know and has taken it in a very different direction from myself. I love to write about these things, to talk about these things, to participate in, you know, peaceful activism.
Right, you're not blowing up. No. You're not trying to blow up beauty supply or release animals from different places, like in this case, the makeup facility where perhaps they're testing with animals.
Yes, which is why he blows up the factory. But I also feel like I understand how he got into that state. You know, I understand the urgency that drives him, and I understand that once you know a certain amount about this, you can't forget it. You can't put it away in a box and live your life as though it's not happening. So I guess my favorite villains are the ones where you're like, well, they kind of have a point, you know, where you're along for the ride for a while, and then eventually they begin to go too far. And Cora falls under his sway, and I kind of wanted the reader to fall under his sway, too. Like, I don't want you to think of her as gullible or as
well. She's also really, I mean, she's what, 11?
She's 9.
Yeah, okay. So she's really little. Yeah. Too, I mean, I was thinking a lot about that when I was reading this. Like, when I was 9, I probably would agree with everything. I did agree with a lot of what my older sister said, and if they said things to me, I would be like, okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what happens when you're a younger sibling,
right?
I feel like,
well, that too. But I wanted him, you know, I wanted that bond of siblinghood to be between them. But I also feel like, you know, sometimes extraordinary measures come from an extraordinary situation, and I think Tucker would believe that he is justified. So I wanted him to be able to believe that, even if I didn't necessarily believe that.
I was also really interested in the thread of this book of trauma and tragedy and how people deal with that. Mm-hmm. And I think that part of, you could say very clearly what changes Tucker is the tornado and losing his parents, and that kind of sets him on this path of eco-terrorism.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much, and there is, I think, kind of this unspoken conversation throughout the whole book about his mental state and his mental health.
Mm-hmm.
How did you deal with that? How did you think about that part of what motivated him?
About what his mental health would
yes.
be? That's an interesting question.
Because he seems kind of a little manic and not making the most rational choices, even the way you described how he talks and he kind of just goes into these states.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting question. I shied away from diagnosing him in the book. I think it's, you know, I'm sure you've seen this on online communities. Someone will say, I'm having this issue with my relative. And everyone will say, that person has narcissistic personality disorder. And you'll think, well, you read three sentences.
Using the web to diagnose medical issues is always an interesting thing.
Yeah. So I think, and I also think that there's a tendency to pathologize certain behavior, I think especially behavior on the part of white men, to say, well, that's not really his fault because of this condition, which is something we have to have sympathy for. And so I was wary of doing that in this case. I think that most people of that age are kind of unstable. Like, have you ever met a teenager? Like, what are they doing?
Or a 20-year-old, right. Right? Yeah. Because he's like 20, which is not the most stable age.
Yeah.
Sure.
So I feel like he's
apologies to all the 20-year-olds who are listening right now. But yes.
I was 20 once. I was a lunatic at that age. But I thought I knew everything. Because that's the thing about that age is that you feel everything so passionately. You're having such big shifts in your personality. If you undergo trauma at that age, I think that just enhances the process. Mm-hmm. And nobody can tell you anything because you know best. And you're the first person to ever have these experiences in the history of the world. So I think it was in my mind that it would if Tucker lived in a different place and had a different kind of support system, he would probably be diagnosed with something. He would probably be, seeing a therapist.
I also was really interested in the way that how when tragedy strikes, how other people deal with that, which is not very well, and how the rest of the town doesn't really help them. Granted, everyone's got a lot of problems. You make that pretty clear. Mm-hmm. This is a small town where a lot of people are really struggling economically in lots of other ways. But it was an interesting commentary to me about how oftentimes as humans, we're pretty ill-equipped to help each other.
Yeah, my grandfather just passed away, and I was thinking about that because people will say, call me if you need anything.
Yeah, they don't know what to say.
Right. But it's also like, I'm never going to call you. Like, I'm never going to call you and say, I need something. It's, we don't know what how to help each other. We don't know what the other person needs. And I also think that there's that kind of magical thinking of this terrible thing has happened. Let's find a reason for it to happen so that it won't happen to me. And that person over there that it happened to is tainted in some way or is bad in some way, brought this on themselves in some way. I am not like that. I will not go near them and get that contagion on me. And we kind of create this narrative which allows us to have less empathy than maybe we should have.
One last question I just wanted to ask you about. You teach as well. Mm-hmm. How does that affect your writing?
I love teaching. I teach at Story Studio Chicago, which is this wonderful writing studio for grown-ups, not for kids. Writing is such a solitary thing, so you're alone in a room and you're having this intuitive, instinctive process that you're creating in silence. And then you go into a place where people say, okay, tell me how to do this process. And you have to think, I know how to do that, but I don't know how to say it in words. I'm going to think about how to say it in words, and then I'm going to understand it better. And then even in my own process, alone in the room in silence again, I'm going to understand better how to do it. So I love teaching writing, A, because it's, talking to other people as opposed to writing alone in my room, which sometimes is good. And also just because it really does help me understand my own work better.
I was trying to describe the Wildlands to some people, and I was thinking one of the things that kind of just came out was, I feel like this is sort of like a Midwest, Oklahoma, Midwest magical realism, if there was such a thing. I don't know if that exists.
There should be such a thing.
I wonder what writers you really get inspiration from.
Oh, I love that question, but I always struggle with that question because I am one of the rare breed of novelists who can't read other novels because it bleeds into my own writing.
Oh, interesting. So you don't read novels. You don't read fiction.
I love fiction so much. I read it so much as a kid.
And now you don't read any fiction.
I don't. So it's like this terrible loss of like all these books, which I'm like, one day maybe. So what I read is nonfiction because that is what feeds my writing. But I will say in terms of writers who I think are interested in the balance of science and nature and, character development and all that. I think, Barbara Kingsolver was a big influence on me. Margaret Atwood in her own way, although hers tends, I think, toward the more magical and mine not so much. Most of what I read is nonfiction. I'm so sorry, fiction writers. I am one of you.
You're one of them. That said, then, so what's really interesting to me that you say that, because I imagine you read a lot of scientific, maybe not articles, but research. And I wonder what you think about the state of how we treat science. Like, do you think that we treat it like fiction nowadays?
Well, it depends who you mean by we.
I think I mean we as a society as a whole.
Yes.
And I mean American society.
Yes. Within that, I feel like there are two different we's. This is a nation which has always had sort of two different populations under one roof, and we don't always get along. And right now we get along even less. But Yes, I feel like there is a vast swath of society which is just not interested in science and sees it as, you know, what alternative facts or whatever the, you know, the jargon is. They don't see it as different than a myth or a story. And they're interested in their own myths or stories. And it just breaks my heart because I feel like there's nothing more beautiful or more true or more magical than science.
And I think that's interesting because I think this is actually something that cuts across political lines, because you have, whether you're talking about, it's not necessarily a conservative or a progressive or a Democrat or Republican thing, if you're thinking about vaccines or climate change or genetically modified crops. I think that I think of oftentimes when I talk to scientists, they feel really attacked by both the right and the left now.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah. I think of science particularly in terms of, you know, evolution, nature. So I was thinking more of sort of the
climate change and those sorts of things.
But no, you're absolutely right. I think my sense is that I was reading an article about this, and unfortunately I can't remember the name of it, but it was talking about how the whole human race changed when we saw our planet from outer space and we realized that we are really this tiny speck in the universe. And I think there's a big part of the population that is just like, nope, I am not engaging with that. That is too big of an idea. It is too scary. Science is, you know, I want to have just my beliefs and my stories, and I don't want to engage with that. And I think there's another part of the population that's like, this is fascinating. Let's learn more. And that's me.
That said, has your relationship to nature changed since you started writing both your first novel and this? Is so much about the natural world is so fundamental to these stories?
Yes. I think that there's a way, you know, I grew up in an urban environment. And so nature is like, isn't it beautiful? Look at it there. It's like a beautiful painting. And there's a way that you see it as this kind of lovely other. And the more I have learned about science, A, the more I see it as individual things like this particular tree, this species of bird, this, you know, how fungus interacts with different kinds of plant life. But I also see how I am not apart from it and it is not apart from me, and how I used to imagine, like, here's the urban over here, there's the wild over there, they should never connect to each other. But, you know, like, we have animals that live in our houses. And
we have coyotes.
Yes, we do. We have...
And as we're saying this, there's a weird bug that's crawling on the wall.
Yes, right? I noticed that too. It's an ant. Yeah, we have ants and spiders and rats and raccoons and skunks and, you know, house sparrows and plants. And, I mean, you know, our lives are filled with nature, but we have this imagined world in which that's not the case, in which it's something outside.
Hmm. Do you have kids?
I do.
What do you want them to know about nature?
Everything. I have a 5-year-old son, and he learned really early on that if he ever wants mommy's full attention, all he has to do is ask me a question about nature or make an observation. So if it's like, mommy, play trucks with me, I'm like, well, I have a million things to do. But if he's like, mommy, why are there shadows? I'm like, let's just stop everything and discuss this for as long as we need to discuss this. So, yeah. So I'm accidentally training him to be just like me.
So I read an interview from a few years back that this book was originally going to be titled Zoomania. Why did you decide on the Wildlands instead?
Oh, Zoomania. Oh, my heart. So it's actually pronounced Zoomania, which nobody can say. So we officially decided we were going to call it Zoomania because that's what people can say. Zoomania is a word that means an obsession with animals.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But Zoomania, of course, kind of, you can imagine how to spell and picture that word, and it also carries, I think, the same connotation of just like animals mania, wah. And I loved Zoomania. It was, you know, it was the perfect title for me. And you know, we were talking about the diagnosis of Tucker and the possibility of diagnosing a character. I would say that's what he's got, is, you know,
Zoomania.
Yeah, he suffers from Zoomania.
That sounds accurate.
But then as we were getting closer and closer to the book, the movie Zootopia came out. And even my husband kept saying, so how's Zootopia going? And I'd be like, do you mean Zoomania, my novel, as opposed to Zootopia, the movie that our child is watching? And we realized it was too close and people would get it mixed up. But I have hope. I talked to my, it's going to be published in French, and I talked to my French editor, and she says that would be a great title in France. So it may yet happen.
Okay, great. I like The Wildlands. The Wildlands is out on September 4th. Abby, thanks again for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's been more than a year since University of Illinois visiting scholar Yingying Zhang went missing. She hasn't been seen since last June, although law enforcement officials have arrested and charged a man in her kidnapping and death. She was actually last seen right in front of our studios for WILL on the University of Illinois campus. And since she went missing, Yingying's friends have been placing flowers and stuffed animals next to a tree at the bus stop. The university is now working to create a permanent memorial garden at that site. And I'm joined now in our Urbana studios by two people who are among the many volunteers who will be working on the garden, Yan Li and Yulin Li. Both of you, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Yan, you were actually colleagues of Yingying. She was a visiting scholar doing research in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Science. You had just met her. She had just been here for a couple of months.
So I knew Yingying for almost 2 months since she came to U.S. We worked together for some research projects, and she's a very lovely girl, easygoing, and since she just came to U.S. for the first time, she was eager to learn everything about the life in the U.S. and also the research. She asked a lot of questions, and I was so surprised to see such an energetic girl.
She was very excited about her life here at the University of Illinois and the research she was doing.
Yes, exactly.
I can't imagine how hard the past year has been for you, for all of you all. You know, I'm sorry that this is the reason why we're having this conversation. What has the past year been like for you?
So for me, I think I never imagined such a thing would happen to me. I thought it's something that we see on the news and I see in the movie, someone went missing. You know, by the day Ying was missing, we supposed to have dinner together because Ying just came from a very hard field work. And we wanted to celebrate for her for that dinner. And Ying went out and never came back for the dinner. It's very hard for me. And I think to me, a lot of things changed. I know it's peaceful. We have a peaceful life here, but there might be danger or risk hidden there and there.
Mm. And so for you, what really changed, I imagine, was your view of what life was like here?
Not necessarily life here. I just knew that life is so unpredictable.
Yulin, you work for the University of Illinois, but you're also president of the Chinese Student Scholars Association.
Yeah.
As Yen's talking about this, this has been such a difficult thing for all of the students on campus, but particularly the international student population, and then, of course, the Chinese student community. How do you think the past year has been for the Chinese student population on campus?
There's still a lot of students care about this. And actually, these days, we are doing the new students orientation right now, and there's a lot of students and parents ask us, is that safe in the university, or like, can we go alone to our home during the night? That kind of questions. So actually, people take more care about the safety in campus, which I don't think that's not a good thing, a bad thing. I think that's good because people take more care of themselves and take care of their own safety. So I think for us, for Chinese Students and Scholars Association, we should like educate all of our members and all of the Chinese students to take more care of themselves and to avoid these things happen in the future.
And this is something that the Chinese Student Scholars Association, you've done this with other international scholars and students associations on campus. Do you think it is an education piece for international students coming here, having to know a little bit more about safety and being aware of themselves? And maybe, for example, they may not have had to do that in China?
Yeah, actually, as you said, we talk with the other international students organization. And actually, during the orientation happened in our home country, like we have taught all of our newcoming students, there's a lot of safety resources in campus, like the safe walk, safe ride, and the university police. So if you need it, please call it. And we want everyone to be safe in our campus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you've even had visits from the Chinese Consul General has been in Urbana to talk to the students as well?
Yeah,
even
actually.
For the beginning of this school year as well?
Yeah, actually, several days ago, they come to our university and they has talked a lot about the safety things and including the like the this kind of accident. And they want all of the Chinese students and all of the international students to like take care of themselves.
Yulin, do you think this has maybe been, this was such a big story in China. I know that, I imagine there are a lot of families who have students here who are worried about their safety. Do you think this has maybe even deterred students from coming here? Maybe students don't want to enroll at the University of Illinois after this has happened?
To be honest, I don't know, because I can't represent everyone, but there's must be some influence. But actually, I think at this time, the one who has still choose our university, they must take safety reasons very seriously. They know how to take care of themselves. So it may be some influence, but I think our like community is still a safety place. That's not so much influence, but I think students should also take care.
Yin, have you had a chance to speak to Ying Ying's family recently? I wonder how they're doing.
Yes, actually, I told them the news about the university want to build a memorial garden for Ying Ying, and the parents, Ying's parents, they were very grateful and very rest assured a little bit about this. I think their life in China right now is peaceful. They kind of go back to their normal routine. But I can still feel the depression from them. Whenever I talk to her mother, she still can't control herself. She just cried to us.
Sure.
And I think Ying's father is currently working. Has a job, but I can still feel the sorrow when I talk to them. I can definitely feel that they miss their daughter very much. They still want to find their daughter.
There are a lot of questions that there are still out there about her. How do you think the garden? Do you think the garden will maybe help students or the campus or the community heal?
Yes, definitely. I think there are several reasons for us to have this garden. First, it's about we should remember Ying Ying. Ying Ying's case has been, the tragedy to Ying has been happened for more than 1 year, and we still don't know where she is, and what the suspect is still there, and there's no conclusion, some conclusion from the police, and we don't know where Ying is. So I think at this time, and after this anniversary of the tragedy, we should have a place like this for people to come to pray or to just think about her.
I should add, right, we actually did get a statement from the University of Illinois from spokeswoman Robin Kaler, and she said that Ying Ying's disappearance has, of course, affected the entire university community, and they are hoping that establishing this memorial garden will give our community a place to go and reflect on her. The design will create a calm, hopeful, peaceful space for years to come. Yulin, what is the garden? What's the garden supposed to look like when it's completed?
Actually, there's a picture online. You can find it. It's not so big, but I mean, all of the flowers and the things there is very beautiful. Like, and also, as you can see right now, there are some pictures and beers and flowers beside that tree.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, there will be more maybe students and scholars coming to like memorize her.
Mm-hmm.
It will be beautiful.
And the garden is going to be, this construction is going to start soon?
Yeah, actually, it's going to start soon, and it should be done by October, I think.
And so this isn't a very big area. I think it's about, maybe it's about 15 feet by 10 feet or so. We do have photos of the design. We will tweet that out for everyone to see them. Yulin, what do you hope will be the result of having this memorial garden on campus?
We should not forget about Ying Ying and this case. all of the Ying's friends and family still want her to come back soon. So this garden is for, like he said just now, first we should remember her in the future and never forgot about this. And in addition, for the, as I said just now, for the Chinese community and for the international community, after this thing happened, we should take more care of ourselves and the safety things. Students should use those resources and never let these things happen again. So that's mostly what I thought. Yeah.
So your hope, obviously, is that something like this will never happen again. And that, do you feel like the conversations you've had with not just students, but the new scholars, the new graduate students, the postdoc students that are on campus this year, do you feel like this fall people are more prepared to for life here in the U.S. and at the University of Illinois in terms of their safety?
Yeah, definitely. Since this thing happened, they will always remember it. And whenever they think it's not safety anywhere, they will trust their instinct and they maybe find some resources like police or safe rides, safe walks. So I believe like everyone will take more caution in the future.
Do you think that, I wonder how much of the Chinese Consul General, but Yulin, also your work with the Chinese Student Scholars Association, it is to let students know if they're visiting here, if they, to trust their instincts, if they feel uncomfortable in a situation, to make sure that they take care of themselves? Do you think that's an important message that maybe people hadn't understood before?
Actually, like every year's orientation during the new students coming, like, schools, universities, and our organization will also we talk with the students. You should take care of the safety things every year. But I think after these things, they will take much more care, and they will like think it seriously. It's like he said just now. It's not a movie or a story like for others. It's just beside us. It's a real thing, so everybody should take care. Yeah,
I think to me, people should take seriously about their safety. Do not take the chance, because I think for Yingying, she may have thought that everybody's nice here, and so she went on that car. So never take that chance.
Yeah, and I wonder what you want our listeners to know about Yingying. What you want people to remember about her?
I think Yingying kind of represents a large group of international students who come to U.S. Why? The purpose of the coming is to fulfill their dream. Their dream is to study here, to perhaps get a PhD or get a master's degree, and to make them better. So that's why people come to U.S. to this campus.
To make their lives better.
Yeah, to make their lives better. In families, not very good in terms of economic conditions. So Ying wants to come here to learn, to study, and work harder.
And to improve her family.
Yeah, to improve her family.
Mm. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for sharing your stories of her and your experience. Yan Li is a friend of Ying Ying's, working on the Memorial Garden, a postdoctoral researcher, colleague at the University of Illinois. Yulin Li is the president of the Chinese Student Scholars Association. Both of you, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that for wherever you get your smartphone apps, and you can always find past shows there. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. You can also search for us on Facebook, look for the 21st, and like our page. All those links and every other way to contact us, if you'd like to send us an email, leave us a voicemail, or remember our social media handles, all you have to do is visit our website, which is 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lin, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening to The 21st. Have a good day.